All right, welcome into Destination 2026, Houston's countdown to the cup. Well, the countdown is over because the World Cup is over, and what a World Cup it has been. I'm your host, Glenn Davis. Tonight, we are going to get into the seven games here at Houston. I called all of these for the World Feed, and I want to give you a little bit of my perspective on all these games. They all had amazing storylines, amazing work and execution out at Houston Stadium, Energy Stadium. From volunteers to all the heavy hitters, just a fantastic display. The way it all moved, national anthems, flags, it was just a wonder to all the senses. The acoustics, everything, the fan engagement, the fans getting along, the unification, it was all there through the sport of soccer and the World Cup here in Houston. Show tonight is always brought to you by Aramco, Coca-Cola, Southwest, Houston Methodist, Reliant, Quanta, Visit Sugarland, and Rice. And I'll just remind you, the ownership of the sport in Houston, those that play, buy tickets, coach, enjoy the game, have watch parties, run pubs, bars, referee, all of you, ticket buyers, you brought the World Cup here, and I hope you were able to experience it in the way that you wanted, whether it was down at a spectacular fan fest, whether it was out at a spectacular venue with world-class soccer players and teams, which was Energy Stadium, or it was in your backyard, barbecuing with neighbors and friends, however you enjoyed it. Maybe you were at Senate Avenue Brewing. Maybe you were at Hugh O'Connor's Pub. Or maybe you were at any other great pub and place to watch the match in Houston. As long as you took it in and enjoyed it the way you did. And if you're a new soccer fan, well, don't go away, because every Tuesday on ESPN 97.5, we're talking soccer. So stick with us. So let's start talking about it. The sport wasn't introduced to us because of the World Cup, but boy, has it been given a big, big boost. We've been celebrating the sport for generations in Houston, Texas, going way, way back into the 30s, professional teams here since the 60s. We have people from all over the world, Latin America, Africa, Europe, Asia, the Caribbean. Parks across the city every weekend are filled. Pick up youth. In fact, I was out after the World Cup final between Spain and Argentina, and I went to Memorial Park, and lo and behold, there were people in Spain and Argentina jerseys, even some U.S. and Mexico, all playing small-sided games. And they had mothers playing, daughters, sons, fathers, just a mix of all kinds of people just playing, enjoying the game. And that is one of the great sort of byproducts we're going to get from this World Cup. And I do think we have earned some new, unique fans to the sport. And I think the business community now has learned also that there is so much soccer content, you got to be tied into it in the future. And there's a lot of ways you can do that. But those that invested in the game out beyond this World Cup, I think are the ones that really benefited greatly, as opposed to just jumping kind of on the bandwagon at the end. But it is a sport that's woven into the fabric of our community, both from a participation standpoint, from a desire standpoint, from a passion standpoint, and from the fact that we just love the game here in Houston, Texas. So it is woven into the fabric of our community. All right, so let's start match one, Germany versus Curacao, June 14th. This was Group E. This was the first game of seven that I would do here. So Germany comes in with Manuel Neuer and company. I remember I was going downstairs to get a cup of coffee. Their bus came up. And to watch the Germans come off the bus, four-time world champions, was really impressive. They were led out by Rudi Völler. Houston's Caribbean community came out in a big one to capture what Curacao was all about, big competing on the biggest stage. They got a first-ever World Cup goal from Levano Comanencia, who equalized the game in the 21st minute. So that was pretty cool. And then thousands of their fans celebrated. Germany would go on to win 7-1. Kai Havertz would get a pair in that one. Manuel Neuer would be in goal. Match two was Portugal against the Congo. Now, this was really, really another game of interest for me. because the whole building was full of players from or fans from Portugal, and everybody had on a Ronaldo jersey. And it came to me at one point, Portugal and Congo, that, you know what? People aren't necessarily here for Portugal. They're here for Cristiano Ronaldo. And then there was Congo, who got into this World Cup by beating Jamaica in Intercontinental Playoff. Their supporters were amazing. So Portugal comes out with their vaunted midfield that includes Vitinha and Bruno Fernandes. They get a cross and a header finished and go up 1-0. And you're thinking, okay, here we go. Portugal's going to put it in overdrive. Well, Congo decided at this point, no, we're not going to sit back. We're going right after the goal right away. They get one right on the stroke of halftime. They get driven by Yohan Wiese, who plays exceptional for them. And this becomes a proud footballing moment for the Congo because after they get the equalizer in the second half, they revert back to their normal low block defending tactics. They get out with a 1-1 draw against Portugal. And they kind of made themselves, identified themselves to the world in this tournament. So, then match three, we get the Netherlands and Sweden. So this is great matchup. Everybody thought it was going to be Netherlands, Poland, Netherlands, Sweden. And in that game, it ends up being 5-1, the Netherlands. But let me tell you, this game was a lot closer than that score indicates because the Dutch come out in the first 17 minutes. Big question around Ronald Koeman and the Dutch national team was, you know, where are you going to get your goals from? We know you got a talented team. We know you got names, Frankie de Jong, Virgil van Dijk, Crescencio. Made a name for himself. But they come out and get two goals in the first 17 minutes. Great goals. Brian Brobbey. So now you're going, wow, I guess they found their striker. How deep can they go in this World Cup? You know, what's their possibility now? Phenomenal. You get to the hydration break, which was a controversy in this because what I think the hydration break does is give a game that really rewards coaches who do their work in preparation. Now they get the opportunity to bring out the iPad and start coaching. And it's not a coach's game on game day, in my opinion. To a degree, it is, but I think the hydration breaks puts it back into the hands of the coach, which I don't think we want, in my opinion. So after that, Sweden comes out, Isak, Gyökeres, and they are pummeling the Netherlands, and they just don't get the goal that they need to get back into the game. And then the second half, the Netherlands very, very efficient in goal scoring. So they win 5-1. So that was game number three. We had the Dutch bus in Houston, had all the great excitement around a legendary soccer country in the Netherlands, which still seeks out a World Cup to win it. Match four, we go back to Portugal and Uzbekistan. So I'm saying before the game, after Ronaldo played in that opener, and he was not mobile, he was not active, we get Uzbekistan, and I go, okay, this is the game Ronaldo's going to score. And Ronaldo gets two in this one against Uzbekistan, who's coached by the legendary Italian Fabio Cannavaro, who won a World Cup as a key player for Italy and also won the top player of the award as a defender. So Portugal wins this game convincingly. There were some great Uzbek fans in the stadium in blue. Houston again, you know, bears out as being a great stadium for this match. Ronaldo gets his two, and then he becomes the only man to score in six World Cups. So mission accomplished for him. On to match five, Cape Verde against Saudi Arabia. Originally, a match that was not as appealing to the others. Little did we know about Cabo Verde. Many of us had to find it on a map. And this game was open for either team to advance, Cabo Verde or Saudi Arabia. And this kind of introduced people to new football stories. Cape Verde had a historic debut. In the tournament. And Saudi Arabia brought some of their passionate fans to this game as well. Now, the game wasn't that exciting, but because of the result, a draw, what happened was Cabo Verde players were on the field waiting to find out if they advanced or not, and they did. And then it just broke into all these great celebrations. But this was a game that people didn't earmark. They got tickets at a bit better price. And then it all of a sudden turned into a game of consequence of possibly advancing because Saudi Arabia could have advanced as well. So that was our group stage matches. That finished those. And then we went on to the knockout stages. So now we get Brazil coming in with Vini Jr., Carlo Ancelotti, the first foreign coach ever for the Brazilian national team, the Italian, taking on Japan. Japan, highly organized, very, very technical players, lack the goal-scoring punch, and that's what they're going to have to find in the future. But have a lot of great qualities. If they can find out how to produce more goals out of the way they play, they would be even more dangerous. But you can't hope for three transitional moments in a game against the likes of a Brazil to get you past them. So Brazil wins this 2-1. They win the game on a repress. That's how they get their goal. Martinelli gets it to repress. They win the ball. They hit his feet really, really quickly. I think it was Casemiro who hit his feet, if I remember correctly, who's now going to play at Inter Miami. But to see legendary Brazil and the Canary Yellow, the drums, the samba, then you had the Japanese supporters in the building, trademark energy. What an example of sportsmanship Japan is, right? Everything that we see them do from a sportsmanship standpoint, we could model. And this was a very colorful atmosphere. It was great. And it reflected Houston again. But Brazil would go out winners. They would ultimately get knocked out of the tournament, and it was not a great tournament from the standpoint of Brazil. And they would go on in winning this game. They would ultimately get knocked out. Japan would go out here, just didn't have enough firepower. But with their organization, did keep Brazil at bay for quite a bit. Then we get on to match seven. Canada, Morocco on July 4th. Now, we were hoping the Dutch might come back with all those fans. That didn't work out. Canada, having lost a match in Canada under an American manager, Jesse Marsh, had to come to the U.S. to play and lost that home field advantage. So this is Independence Day. This is the 4th of July. It's the 250th anniversary of our country, a huge, huge day here in the U.S. Canada, Morocco is in the building. 3-0 victory for Morocco. Two goals from Unahi and a late finish from Rahimi off the bench. Saibari didn't play in this one, injured. The Atlas Lions go into the quarterfinals. Now, I will say in the first half, Canada had a very good tactical plan. They held Morocco. They frustrated Morocco to the point that, some of the players on Morocco were arguing amongst each other. But Canada couldn't produce that again in the second half. Their downfall was no goals produced out of a great first half. And then Morocco just put on a clinic of transitional soccer, counter-attacking soccer, call it whatever you want. And they get a 3-0 victory. And it becomes, a comfortable win for them in the second half after an uncomfortable first half. Credit to the Canadians. So the celebrations then came after that one. And that would be our last game here in Houston, Canada, Morocco. Then I would go on, before I put a bow on this, I would go to SoFi in California calling these games for the World Feed. And I understand because I had a number of people, quite a few people reach out and say, well, we hear your voice down here at the Fan Fest. So that was fun. And I'm glad some people got to hear that I'm still out there. So it's Belgium after beating the US. It's Belgium against Spain, quarterfinal. Now, Belgium flipped the script on the US in that match by putting a different lineup under Rudy Garcia out, a younger lineup, a higher up the field lineup. And I think they were very, very smart against the U.S. They realized the U.S. had played a number of games against, the Paraguays, the Bosnias, the Australias, who all sat in the low block. Well, it was comfortable for the U.S. to get motivated, confident on the ball, and get a rhythm going. Well, Belgium was smart. Different lineup. They rested their older guys like De Bruyne, put out runners, pressuring players, and they caught the U.S., and we really never were able to handle it on that day. And even when we equalized at 1-1 through Tillman off the free kick, we conceded like 2 minutes later. So it wasn't meant to be. It's a bad game, but the U.S. took us on a very good ride up until that point. I think we all had quarterfinals, a lot of us as the goal. But it was a World Cup for the U.S. where a couple of things were achieved, and I think we have to, be happy about this. We had an aggressive U.S. in a lot of the group games. We haven't had that type of aggression in a U.S. team at a World Cup, playing higher up the field from an attacking standpoint, trying to take the game to an opponent. That first 45 minutes against Paraguay was some of the most uplifting soccer as a U.S. fan and as a product of the U.S. system for me personally, and I think for a lot of people. Really, really excited about that. The things that we were concerned about reared their ugly head when we played Belgium. Matt Fries made a huge mistake in goal. Christian Pulisic, not durable enough. That was a question before the World Cup. This is a real issue with him. And then, our back line got exposed a little bit in this one as well. And those were the three real big talking points for the U.S. Going into that. Now, back to Houston. Well, back to SoFi. Belgium, who really did not play well in this tournament, their coming out game in this tournament was against the U.S. And that's why I think we were pretty confident, because we didn't see a lot out of Belgium, and they were fortunate to get past Senegal. Well, then Belgium plays a good game, and in their mind, their best game against the US. And then they play, I think, is the best game anybody played against Spain in this entire World Cup, and they were the only team to score on them. And we're a very, very dangerous opponent in the quarterfinal against Spain, even though Spain had most of the ball. So just goes to show you. You play good games at the right time in a tournament, it can be very meaningful. So we hosted seven World Cup matches here in Houston. We had stories, we had unifying moments, we had great connection with fans. I got to talk to tons of them. I made a real effort to talk to a lot of fans from other countries on my way in and way out because I wanted to fully embrace the entire experience, because I've been involved in World Cups before and I didn't feel like I really did that. These games reflected our great city, hospitality, unbelievable at running and executing events, like the United States as a whole. It was amazing to talk to people talking about the stadium and how amazing it was. And it's just so incredible. And I'm in the back of my mind going, and yeah, and there are people in the US saying this stadium's outdated. And it reminds you that the infrastructure in the United States is far beyond the rest of the world in a lot of cases. So it showcased a lot of World Cup debutants. I changed my mind on the 48 teams. At first, I was worried about the sacredness. Now, I'm not sure I'm in on 64 or whatever it's going to be, or 68. So I don't know. We saw global superstars here in Houston. We saw the likes of Portugal, Germany, the Netherlands, incredible, great soccer cultures. We saw the Curaçaos, the Congos, the Cabo Verdes, the unique stories of newbies and World Cup debutants. We heard the incredible acoustics in the stadium, the presentation. It was all amazing. We heard the cheering, bellowing throughout Houston and the surrounding area from bars, pubs, parks, people going on fields playing after the games, community centers, wherever, from people that have grown up generationally in this game. So, unforgettable month. The world came to Houston. It felt right at home for all of us. Houston showcased itself beautifully. All the volunteers who worked on this event and everybody who worked on it with the committee. Just great, great work. There are things that I wish were a little bit different, but it was a winner for Houston, Texas, and Houston was a main character historically in a very important World Cup 2026, which right now goes down in history as the biggest in every category. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to Marcelo Balboa. I got two former U.S. men's national team members on this show tonight. We got people who have experience in the game talking about it. Well, first, Marcelo Balboa, who worked for CBS, former U.S. men's national team player, and Tab Ramos here tonight. A lot of interesting stuff on player development, access to the game, all these buzzwords that everybody's saying. By the way, there is no problem with access to the game of soccer in the United States. That is a slogan. We'll take a break. Destination 2026, Houston's countdown to the Cup, Aramco, Coca-Cola Southwest, Houston Methodist, Reliant Quanta, Visit Sugarland, and Rice. We thank all of you so much for bringing this program to us throughout the World Cup.